With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello and welcome to On the Continent on Football Ramble Daily. I'm Luke Moore.
And I'm Andy Brassel.
And coming up today, we're going to talk a bit about Antoine Griezmann at Barcelona. Could he really be moving on this early into his fledgling Barcelona career? We'll talk about the sad death of former Real Madrid president Lorenzo Sanz. We'll talk about two of the brightest coaches working in Europe at the moment. And one of them you might be a bit familiar with. And then, 4 years this week since his passing, we'll celebrate the life of Johan Cruyff.
Rensen Brink stuurt daar Kroll op links weg. Dan komt de voorzet en is Cruyff is scoort en is goal! 2-0! Wat een juweel van een doelpunt! Van Rensen Brink naar Kroll, van Kroll voor, precies op paal. En Cruyff die schitterend scoort.
But before we get into that, I do want to give another re-up for the Football Ramble Daily Patreon. Thank you very much to everyone who's supported so far. There's lots of extra benefits that come along with being a patron on Football Ramble Daily. There is the mailbag show, which Andy is invariably a part of, where you get to ask questions about football. There is Ramble On, a weekly highlights and unheard package of audio as well. There's membership of the Discord where you can chat with us and other listeners on what is essentially a massive WhatsApp group. There's loads of benefits, and you can sign up for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate whatever you want. And also, if you sign up before Friday, the 27th of March, so at the time of recording, that's tomorrow at 5 p.m., you'll be entered into the draw to win a signed Paul Gascoigne 1990 England shirt. And the higher the tier you sign up, the more chance you've got to win. So yeah, that's patreon.com/footballrambledaily. Do sign up on there and support us. It's really very much appreciated. And thank you to everyone who's done so far. Right, that's the admin out of the way. Andy, I was absolutely stunned, and perhaps you weren't, because you know a lot more about European football than me, but I was stunned to read that Sport, the Catalan sport newspaper, are reporting that Antoine Griezmann may soon be moved on from Barcelona, not a year into his career there. What did you make of this news, and what do you think it means for Barcelona more generally?
Well, Luke, I think that Barcelona have to be flexible in a time like this and examine all possibilities. I mean, we talk about, and we have talked about, all the clubs over the world that are going to be affected by the financial implications of the coronavirus crisis. But I think maybe because they're such a behemoth within European and world football, people haven't really considered Barcelona as one of these. The fact is, if they don't bank all their money for the remaining TV rights of the season, They could have a bit of an issue. You know, they're a team that has spent a lot of money in the transfer market, that needs to get back in the straight and narrow in the Champions League, that's still battling to win La Liga when, of course, we hope football comes back. But they've got a lot of financial obligations, and Barcelona have not had that bottomless pit for a very, very long time. Of course, they've had to take on loans and debt restructuring and all the rest of it a couple of times in this century to get themselves out of a hole. But really, I think it just does go back to those transfer missteps. And you look at where they are with their biggest two signings before Griezmann, Felipe Coutinho and Ousmane Dembélé. And both of those essentially are, you know, over 100 million euro deadweights at the moment. So that they are going to struggle to shift either of those. The fact that there's clearly not been a wonderful chemistry between Griezmann and the pair of Leo Messi and Luis Suarez is probably an issue. Of course, those two very close off the pitch as well.
Tell us more about that, Andy, because is that a personal thing, or is that just the fact that Griezmann's come from a club where he's been playing very different styles of football at Atletico, or is it a bit of both?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I think you can't underestimate the fact that he has come from a very different style of football, and he was playing a very different role in the team as well, because he was the centrepiece rather than a subordinate one. But I do think the fact that they're so close, Messi and Suarez, and that they have been for a number of years, and all of a sudden someone else is thrown into the mix, it has taken a bit of a while to find that click. I would suggest, actually, that in recent weeks, before the current hiatus, there had been suggestions that Griezmann and Messi were starting to make a link between the pair of them. But of course, there are a couple of side effects of the current hiatus. One of them is the fact that Luis Suarez will probably be back fit by the time that football resumes. Now, I think that has an issue on the sort of team that Barcelona put out. And, you know, it wouldn't be the first time that Barcelona had signed a player and a forward player, thought, yeah, stylistically, this isn't happening, and then flogged him a year later. Now they'll hope that they don't take as much of a financial hit as they did when they moved on Zlatan Ibrahimovic after that one season. But
yeah, I was just going to say that. I mean, you touched on it a little bit a second ago, but Ousmane Dembélé, okay, that's probably a bit of bad luck, and he's had it because of the injury problems he's had. The Philippe Coutinho thing to me feels a bit like, because they could sign him, they got so hell-bent on doing so because it was such an elongated saga, they just didn't stop to think too much about whether he would fit or not. And then you've got the Griezmann thing now. I said to you when we chatted about this the other day that I think perhaps it's a little bit early to make a judgment on him. But yeah, if you take all those as read, and then you read into the fact that they're being linked with Neymar and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, it just makes me feel like, as a layman, like, what is going on over there? I mean, it's just, off the pitch, it just seems to be completely ill thought out and ill judged and chaotic.
Yeah, and it has been for a while. And Neymar's been a huge part of that. Remember when Ernesto Valverde took over, one of his key triumphs really was putting the lid back on the bottle, calming things down, getting the team winning, certainly domestically, and really covering the board for a lot of the criticism they were receiving from hardcore Barcelona, match-going Barcelona fans, for what those fans saw as the incompetence of the way they'd been blindsided over the Neymar deal. And that was just really the cherry on the cake of a load of, like, board pratfalls, really. So, I mean, I think the fact that the thinking is muddied and not particularly sharp is something that's not a massive surprise, I think, to anyone who's followed Barcelona. All I would say is, in this time, with so many moving parts, and with the fact that there's all this money locked in Coutinho and Dembélé, and even if they were able to sell them tomorrow, what kind of loss would it be at? You know, it would be an enormous loss to the club, and a loss that really no club out there could particularly afford. They need to be thinking outside the box. So immediately, I think the temptation is to project this as Griezmann's failure, his failure to either get on with Messi and Suarez in a meaningful personal way, or secondly, to make a meaningful impact on the pitch. Now, I agree with you. I think it can be seen as a little bit too soon, but I think they owe it to themselves, Barcelona, to explore every possibility if they do want to refresh and regenerate this squad. And they really do, because some of those players, of course, it will take time for them to grow and adapt. And I'm thinking of Frenkie de Jong, for example. But David Cartledge was telling us a couple of weeks ago, they've not taken their eye off Matthijs de Ligt. So they need some sort of liquidity in the next year or two. And, you know, it seems a weird thing to say because they've only just bought him. But how many more chances are they going to have to sell Griezmann if it might not be working, and it might not be the ideal that they thought it would be?
Is this? I'll take your point. But is this a situation where, if you are a forward player signing for Barcelona in this era, you need to essentially be able to do whatever Leo Messi or Luis Suarez tells you to do, play in exactly the way they want you to play? And if you don't fit in, you're in big trouble, because the coaching role at Barcelona is clearly quite transient.
Yes.
But players like particularly Messi, who is synonymous with the club and will have a far greater impact to the club when he leaves than any coach would. Is it a case of that you've got to fall into line, particularly if you're a forward player, when you sign in this era? Because otherwise you're not going to get anywhere, because they're not going to like it and they're not going to stand for it.
And it's really not ideal, is it, if you're moving to the timeline of someone who's into his 30s now, even if he is the greatest player in the world. I think that's an absolute issue. And you're right with Suarez as well. I think the fact that he's been away from the pitch for a while can almost make us forget the fact that before he was injured, the talk was, and had been for most of this season, they've got to find a medium-term replacement for him because he's not going to last forever. People were talking about him moving to MLS, for example, as soon as this year, because he has had consistent injury trouble with that knee. So I think pinning your plan to either of those two players, again, is not ideal thinking. And you know, I think you've got these issues all over the team, really. Of course, we think of the forward players first because they're animated by Messi. But I think if you go further back in the team, you know, there's the viable question of do De Jong and Busquets fit in the same team? And even though Busquets is only 31, is he past his best? I think there is an argument to say yes. I think you look elsewhere on the pitch and see that Rakitic and Vidal have been really, really important to them this season. And, you know, they would have sold both of those in the last year if they could have done. So, you know, Barcelona have a total identity crisis. And certainly in terms of the project they've had over the last year and a half, 2 years of making the team younger, for now, at least, it's not worked.
Yeah, I think Busquets is an interesting one, chiefly because he's a type of player who's only ever going to be as good as the players around him, because he's a facilitator. He's a kind of get the ball, give the ball type player. And I understand that as he gets older, he won't be able to win the ball back or intercept as much as he did in the past. But when he came up playing with Xavi and Iniesta either side of him, and he would just facilitate them and hardly ever give the ball away, it is going to be a case of that it's going to be diminishing returns if the players around him in that midfield aren't as good as those players, and no one is as good as those players. So I feel a little bit for him, but I absolutely take your point. So on going back to circling round then, going back to Griezmann, I mean, I was stunned when I first read this, but now you've explained it, I do get it a little bit more. But is your feeling that he will move on then, or is because of everything that's going on at the moment, is it just too difficult to say?
I think it's too difficult to say, and I think it's also a transfer that's very, very difficult to hang your hat on because we don't know.
So what would the candidates be? I mean, I don't really know what the options for him would be.
Well, the ones that were immediately mentioned by Sport were all Premier League clubs. Now, I think straight away you can rule Arsenal out of that. That to me seems really unlikely, because even if they were to sell Aubameyang and Lacazette, how much would they get for players who have a certain amount left on their contract? Also, we have to bear in mind that Lacazette and Griezmann are quite close. And I know, if you were Lacazette, would you say, yeah, go there, you'll win loads of trophies? I don't know. I think that's something that's worth looking into as well. And also, because it would be a transfer where they would look to get back most of the money that they spent, how many transfers of 100 million plus do we see happening once football restarts? I'm not convinced that many, to be perfectly
honest. They're all at Barcelona. Unless Barcelona want to sign in themselves, it's not going to happen. Is that what you're saying?
Basically, what Barcelona are going to be like, I reckon, in 4 months' time. You know when there's that website where if you're going out for the evening and you want a top-of-the-range handbag to impress people, you rent it off this site for a week. I think Barcelona are going to be like that, because they
have a Barcelona section for their players.
Yeah, they can't shift any of these guys, so they're just gonna loan them all out. But obviously that has a knock on difficulty for them, because of course this was one of the things mentioned in Sport, like the idea that they would loan Griezmann. I mean, if they're not going to make any money from him, does it really make that much sense? I mean, he earns less money than he did at Atletico, which I think's interesting as well. So we're not talking, of course they'd make a saving with the wages, but if they're not getting rid of Coutinho and Dembélé, and goodness knows what happens to Coutinho next season after Bayern don't permanently sign him, I mean, it is complicated, as Facebook would say.
If they end up with that situation, they'll have three players on loan who together add up to more of the total value than most of the football clubs in the world.
Yes. That is the long and the short of it.
Which is an incredible situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We'll watch that unravel with interest and see how it develops. I mean, moving to the other biggest club in Spain. Really sad to see the tragic death of Lorenzo Sanz, ex-Real Madrid president, through coronavirus earlier this week, or I think the back end of last week. If people listening aren't too familiar with Lorenzo Sanz, I would suggest it's possibly because other more high-profile presidents like Florentino Perez have stolen quite a lot of the limelight at Real Madrid. But Sanz was the guy who was in charge at Real Madrid when they finally won their seventh European Cup, a trophy they'd waited 32 years for, by the way. So never mind La Decima, which took ages to come around. La Septima took even longer. And Andy, he was a larger-than-life character who did an awful lot for what the club represents and what it's gone on to achieve, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. And it's interesting that you point out that he's kind of overshadowed by other Real Madrid presidents, because the fact is, Florentino Perez, as you just mentioned, directly followed him. And the first thing he did was sign Luis Figo and herald the start of the Galacticos era. So... you can forget. I think if you go back to the period of Lorenzo Sanz, the only way you can really define it is, I mean, he did win two Champions Leagues, but really it was all about the 1998 one against Juventus, La Settima. Because before we got obsessed with talking about La Decima, the 10th, it was La Settima, the 7th, because they'd gone over 30 years without winning the Champions League. Now, for Real Madrid, the team that had a hand in creating the Champions League under another previous president, Santiago Bernabeu, won the first five editions. For them not to... It made them who they are, the European Cup stroke Champions League. I mean, you can't say that enough if you're talking about the historical identity of Real Madrid. I remember... interviewing Emilio Butragueño many years ago,
when the Vulture,
that's right, when he was the sporting director of the club, overlooking the pitch at the Bernabeu, and him saying, what you have to understand is everything that Real Madrid are, the way we see ourselves and the way the world sees us, is all about the European Cup stroke Champions League. And if you'd have spoken to him that day, and in fact, nothing that I've heard from anyone of power at the club since has really convinced me of anything else than the thing that we always come back to, the fact that the Champions League is more important to them than La Liga. And I know Zidane said at the start of this season, for example, that or at the end of last season, that our aim for 2019-20 is to win back La Liga.
That's because he saw his squad. Really, this is a tribute act here.
Maybe he saw Barcelona's as well. I think that's a possible argument. But the fact that Lorenzo Sanz was able to do that and win that game in 1998 in Amsterdam, the fact that one of his signings, Predrag Mijatovic, scored the goal, these are all absolutely pivotal moments that were engraved in the heads of most Real Madrid supporters. And if you think about it, I mean, you know, we can sort of talk about footballers as a series of sliding doors moments, can't we? I mean, Real Madrid actually had a pretty rotten 97-98 season because, of course, they won the Champions League. And before we had the 2005 kerfuffle about Liverpool finishing outside the top four and then being needing to be stuck in the qualifiers so they could defend it the following season. And of course, we had a similar situation with Chelsea in 2012, which elicited the actual rule change. It was Zaragoza who got the last Champions League place in 1998. And it's why I could never really understand like the discussion in Premier League circles over it, because it was quite simple. Basically, once Real Madrid won the 1998 Champions League, La Liga just said to Real Zaragoza, well, sorry, but they've got to be in it, so off you go. And and that was that, really.
I'm not sure if that's a fairer way of doing it.
it's probably only people outside, the only people who would have been bothered by it were people in Zaragoza and Barcelona, I think. But having said that, it goes to show that legends are made by fleeting moments and by chance as much as anything else. And Lorenzo Sanz, he always assumed all his decisions, all his responsibilities. He was one of those presidents. He was almost like a de facto sporting director as well. You know, he did get out there and make signings, and it's what he really liked to do. He liked to get involved in actual scouting of players as well before he pulled the trigger on a deal. Of course, at Nicola Anelka, who a lot of people will look at as one of his most successful ones. And you and I were looking at that old photo, weren't we, of like the day that Anelka signed, and Lorenzo Sanz with his arm around him. And it looks like, you know, it could be like a junior relative or something like that, doesn't it? You know, godson or something like that. It's funny because like people will look at that as one of the most unsuccessful signings, one of the most profligate signings of the Lorenzo Sanz era. But you know what? He made a massive contribution in the sharp end of that 2000 Champions League win. You know, he was brilliant in the semi-finals. He was really, really important in that. So even he weighed in a Champions League context. And as we said, you know, that's the thing that counts above everything else at the Bernabeu. And you know, he was a character who people really warmed to, even if historically he was just completely overshadowed by the first Galacticos era.
Yeah, I was interested to read that when he finally delivered the seventh European Cup and then delivered another one afterwards, and I think it ended up being two European Cups in 5 years. I mean, after Real Madrid fans had... Two and 3 years, sorry, and after the whole Real Madrid community had been so desperate for it, he was unceremoniously dumped not very long after that for an entirely new president. It is so funny from the outside looking in how fickle Real Madrid fans can appear. And I think he tried to become president again for another time, but it was foiled in his attempt to do so. So, I mean, look, his place in history, and not just in Real Madrid history or just in Spanish football history, but in football generally, is secure. Very sad to see him his passing, and obviously we wish all the best to his family and friends.
In by Roberto Carlos, headed away as far as McManaman. A moment of brilliance from Steve McManaman, and the England international, with both feet off the ground, volleys this into the bottom corner near the midway point in the second half.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Andy, let's move across to two of the most interesting and brightest coaches in Europe as we record this episode. I said in the intro that people will be familiar with one of them, and I think I'll start with him. That's Marseille's André Villas-Boas. Now, give people a quick sort of quick appraisal of what he's been up to since he left these shores, and what position he finds himself in now, because Marseille are doing very, very well. He's got some great performances out of some key players, and they're on an amazing run of form. And this break in the football season has come at a terrible time for them. But what do you make of what AVB has achieved so far at Marseille, and what has he been doing in the interim period, for those who can't quite remember?
Well, maybe we should go through his entire career, actually, Luke, because you're looking at a guy who's only 40...
So about 48 clubs, mate. So just do it quickly.
Deep breath. But the fact is, at 42 years of age, he's done Académica de Coimbra, Porto, Chelsea, Spurs, Zenit St. Petersburg, Shanghai SIPG, and now Marseille with a sabbatical in the middle between Chinese Super League and Ligue 1, which is extraordinary. And I think that the fact that once he went to first Zenit and then China, I mean, he always said he wasn't going to coach for that long. He wasn't going to coach till he was like mid-50s or anything like that. He's always had an out date. I think people wondered, you know, he took some time off after the birth of his first child. And I think people wondered whether he would come back, to be perfectly honest. That there were... he was always someone who was quite impulsive and hot-headed. Of course, him and Jose Mourinho never really saw eye to eye on the fact that he left his staff at Inter to go and manage Académica, something that Mourinho wasn't completely on board with.
What was that, Andy? Did he do just for selfish reasons from Jose Mourinho, because he felt like it was too early for him, or do you know the ins and outs of that?
Well, Mourinho has always claimed that he never had an issue with it.
Right. So he definitely did then.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that he relied on him and he would have missed him. But I think as well, he looked at that and he thought, well, Académica at the time were like rooted to the bottom of the Portuguese top flight. He thought, really? You know, I really think he did look at it and think, is that the right move as well? I suspect there was a bit of selfishness in it as well. But I mean, Villas-Boas always had this end date in mind, and he was never hanging about. I mean, it's amazing that he only had one season at Porto, one absolutely glorious season.
Yeah.
But he went to Chelsea too soon. Then I think at Spurs, he kind of rode back from his football principles, having been stung a bit at Chelsea a bit too quickly.
Yeah, is he too impulsive, Andy, on that note? Do you think he's a bit of a windsock when things don't go quite well enough, and he doesn't sort of have the courage of his convictions, possibly because at that point he was quite a young man?
Well, I do think he is generally quite an impulsive character. I mean, you look at how he left Zenit in the end when he was upset about the way they changed the rules regarding foreign players, and he didn't really think he could work with it. It was something that led to the sale of Salomon Rondon, of course, who came over to the Premier League.
Can't imagine quitting over Salomon Rondon. It's a mad situation, that.
Is it fair to say indicative of an issue rather than a particular player? No offence, Solomon. But given all that has happened, I think that what he's done at Marseille has been absolutely remarkable, because I think when he took over the job, he knew that there were financial limits. He knew that the club had an issue with FFP, and yet he took it on thinking, yeah, you know what, I can do something here. I can get us back into the Champions League. I don't think anyone who knew French football really believed he could get Marseille back into the Champions League. And a huge part of that was he was expected along the line to do some selling as well. I mean, obviously they were looking to get rid of some of the biggest earners like Kevin Strootman, Dimitri Payet. They've not been successful in getting rid of either. But given that the club, as we've said on here before on OTC, was trying so hard to sell Payet, the fact that he's managed to make him the central piece of his team, clear his mind and let him get on with it. And Payet has had arguably his best ever season. I mean, he's been really, really good. And it's not dissimilar to the way that he allowed Gareth Bale to take centre stage at Tottenham, for example. You know, he's someone who's been very good like that. I think he's made a couple of very smart tactical changes. The big one has been moving Boubacar Camara, who's best defender, into midfield as this sort of holding player, which has worked brilliantly for them. But other players who were either young players who were struggling to hit their potential, like Duye Saletasar, or whether it be Stev Mandanda, who really not got back to his best since the move to Crystal Palace that didn't work out, but has been brilliant this season. He's got more out of everyone, and you know that they will totally deserve to make it into the Champions League, which they surely will do if this season reaches an end at some point. I don't think you can understate what a big achievement it is to be able to do that.
Yeah, he's done a really good job with, I was saying this to you the other day, he's done a really good job with Dario Benedetto as well, a guy who's come over to Europe for the first time at quite a late stage in his career, and it could have been a really difficult transition for him. I think he's 29 now. Yeah, he's made a real contribution to the team this season, hasn't he?
Yeah, and I do think the fact that Villas-Boas understands what it takes for a South American player to settle in Europe is very important there as well. Something which, if you're the coach for a Portuguese club, you have to be really adept at. That's something that he's done really well as well. And Benedetto's been great. But I was saying to you just the other day, I think one of the key points of Marseille's season is probably about five games into the season. They're playing away at Nantes. They get a penalty in the first 5 minutes. Benedetto, who's quite keen to get off the mark, takes the ball off Payet, sticks it on the spot, and then basically clouts it out the stadium. It goes so far over the top, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And yet no one blamed anyone. They went on to not win the game. But, you know, there was... It kind of reminded me of, you know, there were various issues during his season at Porto, for example. I mean, you look at the start of the season, Radamel Falcao wasn't feeling himself at the start of the season. He didn't have any proper rhythm. He was getting quite annoyed with himself about it. And Villas-Boas told him to take a step back and relax and it would be okay. Freddy Guarín, who ended up being really important in the run-in, he didn't play a lot in the first half of the season as well. So I know people find him very easy to mock, but this is a guy who, in a few jobs, has proved himself really, really good with individual players. Like I said, his impulsiveness is an issue. And I don't think that will necessarily ever leave him, because that's part of his character. I mean, if we go back earlier this season, when Marseille brought in someone who's a specialist in selling players to the Premier League, Villas-Boas got a bit twitchy, and unsurprisingly so. And he was pretty forthright in coming out and saying that in a press conference as well. But on the other hand, it's something that he's managed to get past. And like I said, I think it's very, very hard to deny the evidence of what he manages to do with individual players, especially in quite unpromising situations.
Yeah, I often think, and it's long been the opinion of several people at Football Ramble Daily, both on and off air, that that VS Boas had a bit of a tougher time in the press over here than he would have done had he not been a quite handsome, urbane, multilingual, impressive, high achiever. I think that that profile of human being does tend to get a few of the guys in Fleet Street all frothy with jealousy and rage. So that might have been why he got a little bit of a short shrift. I'm not saying he was perfect or that he achieved millions and millions of different things, but he came to the country as a young coach, as a promising young coach. I feel like looking back on it now, he was probably chewed up a little bit and spat out again.
You forgot to say borderline aristocracy as well.
Oh, exactly. So that's not going to go down well either. Yeah, no, true. But I wonder if he'll come back and have another go at some point. But if he doesn't, then, you know, good on him. He's having a great time at Marseille. And you mentioned that game against Nantes, which I think was the league game. They lost two games around that time. One was a league game, one was a cup game. But if it was the league game, that's the first league game they actually lost since they were beaten by PSG way back towards the start of the season. And they really had a go at PSG that day as well, in a way that most clubs wouldn't. They were beaten 4-0. But since then, they've been absolutely fantastic.
It's a freebie, right?
Moving from one exciting youngish coach to another exciting youngish coach, but one with a completely different profile in terms of the fact that he's not itinerant, he's not moved anywhere. And that's Simone Inzaghi, who's doing a fantastic job at Lazio. We've touched on Lazio on a number of occasions on OTC this season, but I thought this pause in the season would give us a good opportunity to look at him a little bit more closely. I mean, he wouldn't have even been in the job if it wasn't for Marcelo Bielsa's latest meltdown. And he's doing an absolutely incredible job there in Rome, isn't he?
He really is. And that worked out brilliantly for him and for Bielsa in the end, because obviously Bielsa's been having a terrific time in Yorkshire ever since.
It's a sentence that you never really thought you'd hear yourself say.
It's not, which is exactly why it bears repeating, I would argue. But yeah, Inzaghi's been absolutely fantastic. And I think he's been a bit of a slow burner, because we're not talking about Cragnotti era Lazio, really brazen and brash and spending...
Although he did play under that era.
Yeah, exactly. But we're not talking about, in terms of governorship, we're not talking about that era of Lazio in which they were big and brash and spent all the money they had and quite a lot that they didn't have as well. Because he's pieced together this team quite painstakingly, really. And what's worked, I think, very, very well for him is, and we talked about sliding doors earlier, that the fact that he's been able to keep onto the core of his team for a couple of years. Now, they've done so brilliantly this season that, to me, it seems enormously unlikely that whether they win Serie A or not, should it be complete, I would be amazed if he were to go into whatever form next season takes with the same team.
That's interesting. Were you thinking of players like Milinkovic-Savic and one or two others?
Yeah, I mean, what worked so brilliantly really for him is, I think Milinkovic-Savic is a huge part of it. The fact that Lazio kind of overestimated the market there was out there for him. They put a nine-figure price tag on him, and basically there wasn't the level of interest outside Serie A that they really thought there would be. And he was a player who, at the time, obviously there's the Cristiano Ronaldo exception, and this was before that. Even Juventus, who were interested, and Milan were another one, they wouldn't have been able to do a straight cash deal. It would have had to be something loaned, staggered payments, all that sort of stuff. And it really had an effect on Milinkovic-Savic in 18-19, I think.
He dropped off a cliff form-wise, didn't he, for that season, last season, yeah.
Yeah, he was really below his best. But this season he's been absolutely fantastic again. I think a pivotal thing is winning the Coppa Italia last season. The fact that Milinkovic-Savic scored the winner in that was something that made a huge difference as well. But that he was able to hold on to these guys this season. So I think Milinkovic-Savic, Luis Alberto, all important players and that have made a massive difference to them. The midfield is terrific. It's really, really good. But it's the way they move as a unit. You know, they're such a good counter-attacking team. That's why I think it suits Ciro Immobile so well. Though I have to say, one of the things that's impressed me the most about him this season is the fact that he can actually do stuff outside the penalty box, which wasn't always apparent in his younger days. I mean, you look at him, 27 goals in 25 starts. There's another 7 assists on top of that, which is a fair return for someone who's thought of as just a penalty box player. So, I mean, this is their time. It's the right time for them. And I think when Serie A broke, you looked at it and they were totally deserved leaders. You know, they were absolutely fantastic. Consistency's been unbelievable. And again, I think it's something we might have mentioned on here before, but with the return of Leonardo to Paris Saint-Germain, there was speculation that he would want to take Milinkovic-Savic, maybe Adam Maricic, the wide player, and Inzaghi himself over to Paris Saint-Germain should Thomas Tuchel leave. Now, I mean, Inzaghi has been linked with Juventus before, and who knows, maybe that job will be open again when we come into the next campaign, or certainly in the next year. Lazio have done well to hide Inzaghi for a while because he's not particularly loud. But I mean, people can't go on ignoring Inzaghi. He's been absolutely fantastic for Lazio, and it has been, you know, the greatest accident of fate for them. But I think he would excel at a bigger club.
Ajax, The Hague, January 2nd, 1972. Cruyff receives, passes Kries Weimar in one fluent movement. And then there is nothing The Hague goalie Tone T can do to save this one. Of all of Johan Cruyff's goals, this is perhaps his most memorable.
All right, I think when I was planning this show earlier this week, I thought, you know what, it's a good opportunity to have a bit of fun and a little sort of departure from the norm. And Andy, then you popped up on my WhatsApp and said, "Oh, did you know it's 4 years this week since Johan Cruyff passed away?" And I thought, right, we're going to get involved in a bit of that. By the way, as I say that, I mean, just to give people a bit of a flavour of what's happening, we're recording this quite early on Thursday morning, and West Norwood, where I live in South London, is just coming to life. People are just starting to wake up and go about their business or their government mandated one piece of exercise a day. But also what's happening is it's bin day in West Norwood. So you might be able to hear the bin lorry outside the back of my house. If you can, I apologise for that. But that's just to let you know that it is real what's going on. We are self-isolating ourselves and recording from our respective homes. So if you can hear the bins in the background, I apologise for the colourful language. it's a first time for everything here on Football Ramble Daily. And someone doing the bins in the background is certainly that. But anyway, I was just saying that, yeah, 4 years, as you said, Andy, that since Johan Cruyff passed away. And it's a great opportunity for us to perhaps talk a bit about him as a player, about what his legacy represents and just what he's given to football in his playing career, his management career, his philosophy as well. Still a character that looms large all over the modern game, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. And it's something that, you know, we would have been discussing even more in different circumstances, because it was set for it to be a national day of celebration in the Netherlands this year for his birthday on 25th of April, and a few days before that they were going to inaugurate a bronze statue outside the now named Johan Cruyff Arena, outside the entrance to that. Around the same time, because it was going to be like a mini Cruyff festival, they were going to have a run called the Cruyff Legacy 14K. Obviously 14K after his shirt number as well. So, you know, he's never far from our thoughts. And as well, I think you look at Barcelona, going back to the beginning of the podcast, and the fact that Quique Setién, despite in many ways, if you simply look at his CV, looking like quite underqualified for a job of the stature of Barcelona, the selling point was, oh, well, he's Cruyffian. You know, as if that's going to make everything all right, because Cruyff is still the comfort blanket and, you know, the ideological centering of what Barcelona is meant to be about.
Yeah, and I think it is worth pointing out for some of our younger listeners. I'm always really keen to try and bust myths and explain things that need to be explained if I'm able to do so. And for some of our younger listeners, it'll be a bit like what I was like when I was a kid, which is, you know about Johan Cruyff, you hear about him, your dad talks about him, and you understand that he was a legend in the game for how good he was as a player. But what is it about Cruyff, just for people who don't know, Andy, that makes him so important for football in a wider sense?
Well, it's not just his quality as a player, as you pointed out, although, you know, there's an argument that he's the best European player of all time. I think the style and the grace are a huge part of it. And when you look at the line that runs throughout all of his career, it's really about the fact that there's a philosophy. And as there were... as they were referring to it in L'Équipe earlier this week, they were saying, where is it? I've just looked up this quote. It's an icon, an inspiration, then a successful coach, simultaneously revolutionary and dogmatic. And I think that's a really good way of describing it, actually, because he was someone who was, you know, prepared to go down in flames with his principles. You know, he had his idea of how the game would be played. And now if you look at the two clubs in the world, arguably, who've got the most recognisable philosophy, on-pitch philosophy, is Ajax and Barcelona. And he made a huge difference. He made a huge influence in rolling that out in both those places. I mean, I think people can forget sometimes because Rinus Michels, of course, moved on after the first of Ajax's three European Cups in a row, that Johan Cruyff stuck around. He didn't go to Barcelona immediately, and he won those three European Cups in a row before he went off to Barcelona, and in tandem with Michels made so much of a difference to the way they played the game. Then when he came back as a coach, I mean, I think it's interesting to draw the parallel when we're talking about the Barcelona side of Cruyff, of when he arrived there as a player and when he arrived there as a coach, because both arrivals were when Barcelona were also ranked, really. Because when he won the title in his first season with Barcelona and they hammered Real Madrid in the Clásico, and he won the Ballon d'Or that year as well in 74. I mean, they hadn't won the title for 13, 14 years at that point, Barcelona, which seems absolutely unthinkable now, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then when he came back in 89 as coach, Josep Luis Núñez, the president, was having arguments with everyone. He got rid of a ton of players and the coach. And when he brought Cruyff in, Cruyff was almost like a human shield for him, really. And then he said, right, okay, this is the way we need to play all the way throughout the club. And he set that philosophy and that idea of La Masia, the academy, serving the Barcelona first team, comes from there. So, you know, you think about the dream team in the early 90s and those four successive titles and Barcelona's first European Cup and all that, but it was actually the fact that he set the philosophy for the club going forward. And then I think you go on even later to when he'd like post heart attack and surgery and all that sort of stuff. And when he sort of retired from frontline football, he continued to be an advisor and some would say provocateur. And he had a hand in Frank Rijkaard arriving at Barcelona, which I think fired modern Barcelona as we know them. He had a hand in Pep Guardiola becoming the coach ahead of Jose Mourinho when that happened back in 2008. And then when he went and worked with Edwin van der Sar at Ajax, he put everything in place, arguably to produce the great Ajax side that we saw last season, to bring Ajax back to those principles of leaning on the academy and working with young players of a particular technical spec, as he always wanted to do. So his philosophy never stopped being involved in the game throughout his life, whether he was player, coach, or when he wasn't even, you know, in frontline football anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And his presence still looms large all over football now. All these things you're talking about here are still being felt all over European football. And one thing you didn't touch on is actually that even when he's not intending to influence the game, he's still doing so. Because if you think about the lineage that goes through from Ajax through to Barcelona all the way through up to Pep Guardiola, well, Jonathan Wilson of this parish and other much more learned people about the game than me would say that, well, Jose Mourinho's philosophy is the anti-Cruyffian. He's being influenced in almost an oblique way to do things differently because he doesn't like that philosophy, but his philosophy is almost a reaction to it. So whatever you think of how he liked to play the game and what he thought about the game, you really can't ignore it, can you?
Absolutely. And I think the fact that Guardiola is probably the most iconic coach, certainly in terms of his principles on the game and what he believes football should be stylistically nowadays, he's a total Cruyff disciple. You know, he comes out of that era when Johan Cruyff was first coach of Barcelona in the early 90s. And there's that great quote from Guardiola, isn't there? That he built the cathedral, and we're just maintaining it. We're just looking after it.
Mm. It's typically high-minded from Pep, isn't it? Typical sort of stuff exactly you expect to say as he screams in the face of Nathan Redmond. anyway, I think that's pretty much everything for this week, Andy. Thank you very much for keeping me company and, as ever, informing me, enlightening me and entertaining me. I hope if you're listening, you've enjoyed it as well. A final shout out for our patron, patreon.com/footballrambledaily. Lots of extra stuff on there. A chance to win a signed Paul Gascoigne framed 1990 England shirt as well. So don't sleep on that. Sign up between now and 5 p.m. on Friday. Tomorrow, I'll be back alongside Marcus, Jim and Pete for the preview show. The Blizzard will be back on Saturday as well before we rock up on Monday and do it all over again. This coronavirus is not going to stop us. So make sure you keep listening, subscribe, download, all that good stuff. And we'll see you next time. Thank you very much indeed for your company, Andy.
Thank you.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.